Back once again. It is Box Office Battles with Greg and Eric on a Tuesday night. If you're watching the live stream on YouTube or Twitch or Facebook Live, glad to have you on board. We are still covering round one of the best bad movies ever. And tonight we have a special treat, if you will. We have two just delightful films.
Maybe the best matchup we've ever had.
It could be. It's
the
a close
one. The good news is that as of the opening song of this episode,
yes,
we are more than halfway through this thing that we have put ourselves.
It's true. It's true. And we'll recap where we're at in the best bad movies. We kind of came up with this on the fly. We had a kind of different opinion on how we're going to do it, but then it kind of settled on, hey, let's do the movies that are like so bad. And so the winner of each one is actually the one that we think is the worst of the two movies. Previous box office battles that we've done has been the best of the two movies, and now we're doing the absolute worst. Eric put together one side of the bracket. I put together another. Last week, we had our loser slash winner, Mac and Me, which was, yeah, very, very entertaining for all
dumbest,
the wrong reasons.
Dumb as shit. Dumb. So dumb.
And, you know, it went up against Plan 9 from Outer Space, which we really enjoyed, so it didn't even stand a chance. But this is where we're at with the bracket. Sound like a fog with corn in there.
There's springs attached to this or something. I don't know. I was just trying to move my microphone 1 inch, which we should know. I should not be trying to do that.
I thought you were warning the ships in the harbor. Anyway, here's our bracket right now. For those of you just listening on the podcast, you won't see this, of course, but our bracket is we have two of the final four already established, Battlefield Earth, which beat Catwoman, and Mac and Me, which beat Plan 9 from Outer Space. And we're going to get into the next round matchup, which is Manos, The Hands of Fate, a delightful excursion.
Hands. The Hands of Fate.
The Hands of Fate. Versus what I like to refer to as a tone-deaf dwarf activism movie that I think has good intentions and fails miserably, and that is Tiptoes. And what's so amazing is we're going to start with Tiptoes, but it's so amazing there's so many good actors in Tiptoes. Oscar winners or Emmy winners, and it's insane.
Gary Oldman, who won an Academy Award for his portrayal of Winston Churchill.
Yes.
And Matthew McConaughey, who won an Academy Award for his portrayal of a guy with AIDS.
Yeah. It's a good movie.
Yeah, Dallas Buyers Club is really good. And that whole, well, that was a phenomenon the year it came out. It won a lot of awards and for good reason. And Kate Beckinsale is in this, right?
Yep, Kate Beckinsale.
Peter Dinklage. Do you think, not Greg, as far as I know, neither one of us has been in professional acting, although I do have some voice acting
credits
floating around out there. But do you think you could do a worse French accent than Peter Dinklage? And do you think the character was written that way, or do you think that he showed up to day one of filming and said, "Hey, guys, what do you think if I did the whole character in French accent?" That shit was terrible.
Yeah. That's just the tip of the iceberg there, of the Tiptoes iceberg. So I hadn't seen this since like it originally had come out. And I've always been a Gary Oldman fan. So I'm like, Gary Oldman, I mean, as a dwarf at that time, you know, kind of count me in. 2002, I believe we were living in England, and I saw it in like the rental shelf, and I'm like, oh, Gary Oldman. I don't even think I knew it was a dwarf movie because we were overseas.
Classic villain.
Yeah. And Gary Oldman. He's fantastic. You know, the professional. He was even good in Lost in Space, the big screen version. I have so many things. Dracula just has a great career. And so, yeah, put this on. And apparently it was a passion project of his.
Oh, he was behind this.
Yeah, from what I've seen in like the behind the scenes stuff was that he wanted this movie made.
And in a film that cast every little person in Hollywood that had a SAG card at the time, he thought to himself, who should play the lead midget?
It's dwarf. We say dwarf.
Dwarf. Who should play the lead dwarf in this?
You're just and like Kate Beckinsale.
And he says, I know who. Gary Oldman. That's who.
I think somebody likened it in one of the things I read was that it's when if the quarterback of the football team decides he's going to play, you're not going to stop him from playing. And he was the captain of that ship. He was the one championing the movie, and he was going to play that lead role. And I think he envisioned for himself, because playing the dwarf, that he was going to, you know, it was like a Dustin Hoffman in Rain Man, playing with somebody with autism, you know, something where they spoof in Tropic Thunder, where you play a disabled person and it's Oscar gold. And I really think that was the aim of this movie. I really think it was. But when you see it, I hadn't seen it in 20 years, but I had remembered it, and I remembered that it was ridiculous. I remembered how awful it was. And not just awful in terms of the dwarf stuff, awful in terms of plot cohesion. The plot is all over the place.
It's bizarre.
It's a mess.
Dude.
But then it came on, the title sequence rolled, and then we get this image of Gary Oldman in this oversized motorcycle going down the highway, and it looked ridiculous. It was silly. And then you have Peter Dinklage right next to him, looked perfectly fine. And I felt bad for both of them in that scene. I'm like, and I remember laughing out loud going, oh my gosh, I forgot how incredibly silly this movie looks.
Okay. And in this very opening scene, Patricia Arquette gets thrown out of a bus and they pick her up.
Yeah.
Dude, I guess I just don't know, but what is the deal with Patricia Arquette? What is she? What is this? I've never seen anything of her in real life or on film that makes me think this should be a successful actress. This should be a person from a famous acting family, and maybe it's nepotism or something, but she seems to have a whole bunch of nothing. She's like a top five power down for me when I see her in anything. What is the deal with this?
Well, I don't know. I know Rosanna Arquette, her sister, is really good. In Pulp Fiction, she has that scene where she's the drug dealer's wife. She's great in it. And the only thing I've ever seen Patricia in that I really thought, she was in Medium, the TV show, for a long time. But the only thing that I really, really liked her in was True Romance with Christian Slater, the Tarantino screenplay. He wrote the screenplay for it. And it's a Tarantino movie. It's a Tarantino, but it's really, really good. And she plays a really good part in that. And that's the only thing I've ever seen her in that I've really been wowed by. Because she's really good in that. But that's about it.
Well, her character, as did every character in this one, had the depth of a kiddie pool.
It was a mess. You talk about her.
You chose Rain Man for your comparison. I was thinking I Am Sam, that we tried to do this, a feel good movie about overcoming disabilities. And I'm not saying that being a midget, being a dwarf is a disability, but they certainly do their best in the film to make it seem like it is a disability. Several times they ask, does it hurt to be a little person?
Yeah, I know, that's really good.
And Greg, I don't know if it hurts to be a little person or not. It hurt watching this movie about little people.
The thing is, and maybe it's today, you know, where there's these shows like Little People, Big World, which my wife really likes and enjoys. There's a lot of Little People shows where they, you know, the reality shows where they get in behind the scenes and you get into their life. But, and I think that the society is a little bit different toward people who are disabled. We don't treat them like freaks. And maybe in 2002, they still were kind of looked that way. But I still think everyone in this film overreacts to dwarfism like somebody had AIDS. They treat dwarfism like it's a death sentence. It's like it's a malignant tumor, and they overemphasize it. And I get that little people have issues and have problems, and we need to make them more aware. But like you said, it is emphasizing it so much to where it becomes comical. And like I said, we got the picture here of Patricia Arquette and on the back of Peter Dinklage's motorcycle. And they're quite the couple in the film. They're, they kind of are just there. I don't know really what
either one of them purpose. You could take them both out of this.
Yeah.
And you lose nothing. In fact, you probably gain a lot because you don't spend any percentage of your time watching it trying to figure out why they're in this, except to maybe fill out the poster or whatever.
Maybe the script was rewritten and they had a bigger arc, but it really is just, they're just
there. I have read. And so, all right. So we don't even, we touched on like Gary Oldman playing a dwarf. And, you know, there is a certain segment of people who, I'm going to be delicate with this or do my best to. And I know that there are times where we want underrepresented people to play the parts of underrepresented characters, right? And to the best of our ability, we ought to try to align those. I think he can get a little too far out there if I'm making a movie about a one-armed Portuguese World War II veteran. Like, I don't have to go find a one-armed Portuguese World War II veteran to play this part.
Yes.
But I do think, like I said, why not just use Peter Dinklage to play that part? He's a pretty good actor. Or what about the guy that played Willow? What was his name?
Warwick Davis,
right? Yeah. We have talented, there were 400 of them in this movie you could have chosen from. Yeah. It was such a odd thing, but it also lends, it opens you up to criticism that probably didn't need to be there, because you're putting yourself into a role that you don't, if the entire movie's about the struggle of what it's like to be a little person, you don't have a real good frame of reference for what that means. And when you're trying to play a character that represents that struggle, it's hard to seem authentic.
Yeah, I thought that's what you're going
in
for, yeah.
That situation.
Yeah.
Now the movie, I will say, does a good job. And I don't recall, maybe you'll correct me if I'm wrong, I don't recall one joke about them not being able to reach something on a high shelf. There was nothing where one of them
might have
ducked
been,
down
might
behind
have
somebody and another one pushed them over. In the movie, they didn't get two standing on top of each other's shoulders and put a coat on them.
That would have been great.
And so
that all is like missed opportunities. Everything you're just saying would have made this movie infinitely better.
Trying to think of every trope I've ever seen of like what
I would have enjoyed that
small people are capable of.
But you know, you're right that Gary Oldman's playing this part, and I get no part is too big, no pun intended.
But we're gonna watch a short clip of.
That's just too easy. But you're right. There are certain situations where if you can cast somebody, a little person, there's some situations where you could cast a blind person playing a blind. There was one, when you were talking about, though, it reminded me of a joke. I want to say it was Ricky Gervais, but don't quote me on that, where he was talking about he played an autistic person or a mentally challenged person in his show. And they were like, oh, that was a missed opportunity. You should have just gotten a mentally challenged person. And he was like, "What do you have you ever tried to act with one of those people?" It's that they wander off at every, you know. So it's like, yeah, there's an opportunity for it. Just want to touch base about the movie itself, which is Tiptoes, if you're just joining us. And in it, Gary Oldman plays a dwarf or a little person, and Matthew McConaughey is his brother, twin brother, who is normal sized, which is just interesting in the fact they're, you know, they're not identical twins, they're fraternal. And so it has to deal with Matthew McConaughey living in this world of little people. And it seems like it would be something that would be great subject matter for the film, but the way they treat the film, it just ends up leaning itself toward the ludicrous, because you have these scenes where Matthew McConaughey, as the only normal-sized person in the little people's world, and the opening...
I thought you were going to say the only normal person. I'm glad you said normal-sized.
Hey, I'm not like that.
I agree, but it just... As you started to say it, time started to slow down, and I was going, don't do that.
Why are you the way that you are? Every time I try to do something fun or exciting, you make it not that way.
I just watched that episode the other night. It's Casino Night. That's from.
But it's the thing is I'm not going to do that. I'm here to have fun. But yeah, the movie itself with the groups of little people, I didn't mind at all. I enjoy that they get a chance to be in the film and kind of show their side of things. The thing I really had was it seemed like every scene, it would start off normal and then it would lean to the bizarre. Like the opening with Matthew McConaughey and Kate Beckinsale, where she's doing the painting and then all of a sudden in the middle of it, she's decided she's just going to give him a BJ and keep him from work. I didn't expect that. when it started that he's checking his watch.
This, in my experience, seems way outside the realm of possibility.
Yeah,
for a woman to decide that you're so desirable that to keep you from leaving, she'd perform oral sex on you. Now, maybe our listeners, this is an everyday occurrence for them.
Maybe if you look like Matthew McConaughey, this
for yours truly
all the time.
Yes, of course. No. He's like, hey,
I might get a handy to go away.
So professional artist Kate Beckinsale.
Yes.
Obviously, they set the film up in the first part where he's hidden the fact that his family is all little people.
He's like ashamed, but I just didn't think it mattered.
And that's the first part. And then the second part is she ends up pregnant.
Yes.
But apparently you can, I guess if you carry the gene, even if you're not a little person, and the person you're having a baby with isn't a little person, you can still create a little person. I'm not a scientist.
Yeah.
Maybe that's true. I don't know. Sure. But yeah, man, like you said, every attempt that they made to have this semblance of, we understand the subject matter that we're talking about. Every time there was an opportunity to lean into the right way to tell the story,
right,
or the consistent way, or the way that shows compassion towards a group of people, every time that presented itself, it's like they just decided, or we could be more bizarre.
Yeah.
Now, I read Peter Dinklage say, first of all, he defended the casting of Gary Oldman as Rolf. And second of all, he claims that there was a director cut of this that was 150 minutes long. So that puts us in at,
Lord have mercy,
2.5 hours. Oh. He said it was a totally different film, that when they were filming it, they felt like, and so this is the, authenticity that I'm looking for, right? Because he claims, and I have no reason not to believe the late, great Peter Dinklage on this.
Late, great.
Well, I don't know. that they did treat it the way the subject matter ought to be treated. And it can be a lighthearted take on it. You know, not everything has to be so serious, but that they treated it with compassion and with, you know, the proper amount of care. And then studio executives got a hold of it, tried to turn it into this rom-com meets, you know, highly informed piece of important art, bastardized it to the point where I believe the original either director or producer tried to get their name removed from this piece of shit. He said this wasn't at all what we set out to make, what my vision was, whatever. But here's, and so all of that's fine. And I think all of that maybe settles upon in your mind. And from the beginning, you had every good intention. Now we know the old saying, but the intention was to make a quality film that treated this subject matter the way it ought to be treated. And all of that could be true, except I saw the original writer also say, I thought about this in college because I thought it'd be funny to make a movie about little people fucking. Well, it can't be both.
Yeah.
Because that's stupid, and that's a stupid thing to say, and it sounds very college idiot thing to say. And so to go from that to, well, I was trying to make the best movie I could, and the studio stripped it down into something unrecognizable from my original vision. Those two don't sync up. The fact is, you made the most bizarre yet entirely predictable movie I've ever seen. I don't know how that works, how it could be so bizarre, but so vanilla.
Yeah.
Characters that were as thin as tissue paper. Like you said, every scene that kind of almost felt like they were going to get it right just to get it wrong.
Oh, without a doubt. Yeah.
So weird, man.
You know, and the thing is I heard about the director walking out and the director's cut. And I'm kind of on your side where you say that that's almost like a cop-out to say, because Peter Dinklage can say he's proud of the movie, but you can't be proud of his accent or the acting or the scenes. You know, they're saying that, well, the editor just put the wrong scenes in. Well, you filmed some really shitty scenes. They're just the perspective, the visual perspective. So you've got Gary Oldman walking around clearly on his knees, clearly, because got the cane, and he's like, it reminded me of Tim Conway when he did Dorf on Golf and Dorf. I'm like, dude, it's Dorf. It's not a real little person. It's somebody with shoes attached to their kneecaps. And I was like, oh my gosh. It would have been hilarious if it wasn't trying to take itself so seriously. Just the shot of him on the couch. I mean, I can't watch this and take it seriously.
They've got little holes cut out in the couch for his legs to go in. And then they've got pillows inside of jeans hanging over the edge or whatever.
See, you know, he's talking to Kate Beckinsale about his brother, and he just got beat up by his slut girlfriend's boyfriend living. Oh my gosh.
Little people got problems just like all of us.
I think that's
something in real life to keep in mind. People say, be kind, you never know what struggles. Every body I've ever met from all different walks of life, like, really just comes down to, like, how am I going to pay the bills this week? Unexpected expenses. Some relationship drama that I really wish I didn't have to go through right now. You know, it's all kind of like pretty consistent across most everyone I've ever met.
Yeah.
Right. And little people can have those same problems. But when you tried to make this sentimental schlock of a movie, which is fine, sentimental schlock, like you said, often can be award winning stuff because people, you know, the other one is, get a very beautiful actress to make herself ugly. Mm-hmm. Who was it? The monster ball.
No, just Monster with Charlize Theron. That was actually a good film too. Yeah. She plays a serial killer.
Make a beautiful girl.
Yeah.
Fucked up looking and Academy Award bait right off the top.
Yeah, exactly. It just convinced me
it's just immature.
That convinced me that Charlize Theron was really an uggo and not worth my time.
I bought it.
What she looks. That's what she looks like in the morning. Damn, dodged a bullet there. You know, yeah, but it's.
The other thing about Dinklage defending this is, you know, it takes some level of self-awareness to admit the things professionally that you've done that aren't up to standard or aren't up to your expectations. And maybe he was given sold a bill of sale for one a bill of goods for one thing.
Yeah.
It ended up being another. But if he can't sit down and say, you know, so you ask him, okay, Peter, then what did your character bring to this movie? How did your character push either the plot forward, push characters either forward towards being a better person, or how did your character pull them because you're kind of an antagonistic force in them that they have to overcome? You know, your character doesn't have to be central to everything, but it's got to be central to something.
Right.
And it wasn't. And that's the same thing with Patricia Arquette's character is they were only central to each other, but that doesn't help anything because neither one of them were central to anything else.
Yeah, they're just the friends. So speaking of Peter Dinklage, let's show a clip from his performance because this is one of the clips that I put in was where he's having an argument with Gary Oldman's uncle at the dinner party. And it just, this is like the best example of his horrendous acting is this scene.
Our organization has battled long and hard to sweep away those stereotypical images.
Another thing, I think the term little people is demeaning.
What sort of political activity do you suggest we create once we disband because we're so bourgeois?
What you people don't understand is that political power, it grows out of the barrel of a gun.
Yeah, okay. Right. Now you want us to go out and commit violence.
Really?
We don't do that here. Americans don't do that.
Americans?
Yeah, the people that saved your ass during World War II.
Oh, now you want to talk about the fucking war.
Why are we talking to this guy?
He is very passionate.
Don't you patronize me.
Yeah, who do you think you are?
I am French! And I'm proud to be French. I am proud not to eat this disgusting swill you people call cuisine. I am proud.
Here's my friend.
I mean, that pretty much says it all. First of all,
it is the most bizarre.
Why talk about getting rights for little people with a barrel of a gun? And then the other dwarf says that we're Americans. We don't do that.
They just needed a bald eagle to come flying in.
Yeah, the whole discussion made no sense. He's arguing with the uncle. The uncle goes, "Well, he is passionate." Okay, dude, what is the point of the? What is the point of this discussion?
The wife is jacked.
Did you like how McConaughey comes in
muscular
and sets the girl on the stool? And she's like, "Yeah,
okay, right." I was hoping that you, because I didn't catch that the first time, but just everything about it is just so weird, yeah, you know, yeah. Like
speaking of
they
her,
might as well have had him like holding a full-size cup and then pouring into a little like kid cup for the everything that you could again everything you could have done right was just done so incomprehensibly wrong.
She's just unbelievable. And speaking of Rolf's girlfriend, that brings me to my favorite character of the movie, who is only in it for a little while, but makes such an indelible mark, and that is David Alan Grier as Jerry Robin Jr. I could have used a whole film of Jerry Robin Jr. Oh my gosh, it was like because watching.
He's a big part of this
the community
society of little people. He's been welcomed in too, because not only was he the MC and musical artist at the convention, but then he hosted that dinner party that we just saw, and he doesn't mind getting down and dirty with the little folk, because as we see here
in this photo,
a backstory about how he became assimilated into this group.
Yep.
accepted into this group? Was there any fallout to this? This common, you know, is he known to get around these circles? We need to find out more.
That was this whole scene. Well, first of all, David Alan Grier from In Living Color, when he comes on board and with the hair and the performance, all I could see was Sexual Chocolate from Coming to America, Eddie Murphy. Sexual Chocolate, thank you very much, you know. And that's all I saw. It just cracked me up. And then the fact that he hosts the dinner party. And it's such an odd scene because Rolf is looking for his girlfriend. She's already slept with one other guy he walked in on him. And now he's given her another chance. And he can't find her anywhere. Of course, if you're an audience member, does he find her in a bedroom? Does he find her somewhere in the deep recesses of the house where nobody would be present? No, it was like a conservatory right in the middle of the party. And they turn the lights on. It's like there are people everywhere.
Yeah. Well, and if they just turn the lights off, nobody will know.
Oh, my gosh. So it was like, how bizarre that's of all the places where they chose to do it. It just, like I said, nothing fit. Nothing was cohesive in this film. Funny scene, but for the wrong reasons. It's just insane. I did love when later on, when they're at the wedding and the girlfriend sits next to Rolf and she puts her head on his shoulder, he basically goes, get away from me.
You know, sometimes a word as we're watching these just kind of sticks out and attaches itself to everything you're thinking. And for Mac and me, I remember just saying, this is so dumb. Why is this so dumb? And Plan 9 was amateurish, but lightheartedly so. And Battlefield Earth, we just kept saying, this is just terrible, garbage. But bizarre. This one is just bizarre. I mean, again, if you're listening, now, you suggested Tiptoes. I had never heard of it. You did me a great favor by not telling me anything about this. I didn't know why it was called Tiptoes. And the cover art doesn't give you any indication that this is a movie about little people standing on their tiptoes to reach things off of a countertop.
Yeah.
And so as it started, okay, man, I can't even tell you all of the different emotions I went through as I started this. And okay, like you said, it starts with Gary Oldman and Peter Dinklage on these bikes. They pick up Patricia Arquette, and I'm going, okay, well, I know that they were billed on the poster, but I thought this was a Matthew McConaughey flick. So maybe this is just some small aspect of this. Maybe it's the comic relief, you know, dwarves that, you know, getting into trouble in a world that wasn't made for them, you know, but a full-size world there. Well, then the next scene is the art, the blowjob, which was weird. I mean, blowjobs in general are weird. They happen in real life. But
they don't happen in real life. Did you just say that?
Then I'm like, okay, well, maybe it's not about little people. I mean, I'm still struggling with everything that's happening.
Right.
And then the next scene is the convention, and I go, man, they didn't hire 400 little people to film the scene without it needing to be a part of it. And that slow burn of realization, you know, like when you light a tissue on fire, it just burns up. But when you light a cigarette or a cigar or something, you know, that it slowly, and that's how it felt, just that I was being burned from the tips of my feet, and eventually it was going to reach my head. As more and more of this came to light and became more bizarre, and the acting became more bizarre, and the story became more bizarre, and the way every character reacted to everything else happening on screen became more bizarre.
Yeah.
But that clip you just showed us with the dinner party fight, was so out of nowhere. I know they try to set Peter Dinklage up as this French revolutionary, you know, whatever, Marxist guy, but like, people don't talk that way and do that in the middle of a party. Like, it's just so bizarre. Anyway, this movie fucking sucks, dude.
If they do talk that way in the middle of a party, they're usually not invited to another one. They're that guy. Oh, we don't want him. You know, it's like the whole John Lennon lyric, you know, that if you go carrying pictures of Chairman Mao, you ain't going to make it with anyone anyhow. It's okay to want a revolution. You got to know your time and place. But it's, like you said, it is, there's some weird aspects of it. To me, the most, the weirdest person in the whole film, believe it or not, is not Gary Oldman. It's not all the little people. It is Matthew McConaughey himself. The way they craft this character where he has this family of dwarfs that he's from, he seems nice one minute, and then he's a complete total asshole the next. I felt like I missed something. Now, the movie's only 90 minutes, but there's a scene where Kate Beckinsale thinks she's cheating on her, and he says he's not. Then she finds out, oh, he's not cheating on me. He has this dwarf brother. That's what he's been hiding. And then she calls him to let him know about the brother and everything in the party, and he hangs up, and there's some shadowy figure that he's with in the middle of the night. I'm like, did I miss something?
Well, that was his coworker, but he loses his mind
with her in the middle of the night.
Invites her to the party later.
And you see her, and that's it. Apparently they were...
She found some midget strange to get into.
But apparently they were having an affair or not. I don't know. It made no sense. And so... Is Matthew McConaughey a good guy, a bad guy? He finally agrees to marry her, which was just an unbelievable dinner scene where they have this stressful moment where the dad is going to reveal that he doesn't want his daughter marrying, somebody that it's from a dwarf family. And then they go, we just need it to be a Jewish wedding. That's all.
Funny.
So then
I thought that scene was funny,
but it was like the whole buildup. And then they end up having a Jewish wedding, so they throw that in there. And you think, okay, this is fine. And then the baby comes right away. And then all of a sudden everything flips. And then
she says multiple times he needs to get therapy, doesn't want to do it. But like you said, he seemed pretty comfortable with his little people family when he was around them. Like he's dancing with his nieces and he loves Rolf, it appears. He ain't going to love what Rolf is up to, though, towards the end of this movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Because, Greg, I mean, they took us down a road of shit.
Yeah.
And then at the very last minute, listen, the show isn't meant to be a spoiler, but this movie's been out for a while. If you haven't seen it by now, you know, I'm sorry. But listen, McConaughey and Kate are not able to move past their various problems. Their problem being, one, they have a dwarf baby, and two, Matthew McConaughey can't accept his dwarf family, and they split. But guess whose arms, Greg, she falls right into.
Oh, yes.
And Kelsey looks up from playing her word search game on her phone and goes, what the fuck? As this movie ends and fades to black with those two making out.
Yeah. You can kiss me if you want to. Apparently they were supposed to do more than that. And they didn't, the producers wouldn't put that in the film.
If someone told you they got their hands on the 150-minute version of this and they said, Greg, I know you talked about it on your show. Oh. I know you chose it because it's a bad movie. I know you didn't have anything good to say about it. But I think if you'll watch this 150-minute director's cut, that it'll answer a lot of the questions and ease a lot of the concerns you had. Would you watch it?
I would watch it out of curiosity alone because of knowing that there's more to the story. We kind of end it right there. There's no real resolution. He doesn't know that his brother is going to be banging his wife, you know, and raising his son. We don't even know if the kid's a dwarf or not. The fact that Matthew McConaughey loses it, He literally has a conniption in the hospital.
Yes.
And the baby's not even confirmed that he has anything. And they have a dwarf doctor, which I thought was funny. Maybe that's what set him off. It's like, now they're bringing me a dwarf doctor, too.
People are everywhere.
It doesn't. It's so out of character because the character for somebody who is, like you said, in a dwarf family and seems to love everybody in that family, loves his dad. The idea of having a dwarf child for him didn't make any sense. And Kate Beckinsale, it would have made more sense if Kate Beckinsale was upset because he withheld that from her, but she's perfectly fine with it. She's just going to raise it like her kid and do what she's got to do. They've got no choice.
And she does.
Yeah.
She plays that character well. I mean, I guess I would say out of all the characters in the film, she plays hers the best.
Yeah.
Because naturally, if you weren't raised around, you know, I don't know, the quote unquote culture of little people. I mean, we all have our own culture. Mm. So if you weren't raised around that, you'd have a lot of questions. There'd be things you don't know.
Yeah.
And we can make fun of the does it hurt to be a little person
yeah.
quote. It's in the context of the movie, it's wild ass. But in the context of being a person who really doesn't know the answer to that question, in theory, could be having a little person baby. Well, all babies are little, but you know what I mean.
As soon as it comes out and it's small, Matthew kind of goes, I knew it!
Knew it! Look at this small-ass baby! But, you know, at least she gives some...
I agree.
She gives a performance that seems the most normal out of all of this. Now, unfortunately, yeah. the character's put into a world where nothing is normal and everything is, as we have said before, fucking bizarre.
Yeah.
But... she handles it the best. Kate Beckinsale, hats off to you. If you're listening yep. tonight or to the replay, we think you did
a
reasonably okay job given the tools you were given.
Favorite hot vampire, Kate Beckinsale. But yeah, she you actually feel sorry for her in this, that all these things are happening to her because she stays very calm and loving. And that's probably the one character arc that doesn't really change. Because even Rolf, you know, he loves his brother, but he seems like a lech where he's stalking Beckins. It doesn't feel romantic. It feels just creepy.
Yeah.
And he feels creepy. So many scenes where you just look at him and the glasses and everything, he looks like
looks perv. Slimy.
Yeah.
And it
doesn't work.
Hotel that they get together in the beginning of the movie and Trisha Arquette and Dinklage or I don't know, they're trying to get it on and they're drinking and making morphine mixed drinks and
the back scene where she picks him up, Patricia Arquette picks up Dinklage, it adds nothing to the film. It's just very odd.
It sets me misaligned for everything I'm about to see because again, and we've talked about this on a few of these movies, it's called Chekhov's gun, isn't it? Like, don't set this up for me, because it seemed to be a point of emphasis, and you set me off kilter just enough that I see the rest of the movie off kilter.
Yeah, I mean, a character like that, like Dinklage's character, is the character in most films that ends up going too far and either gets killed or put in prison, and then it affects the lead character. It comes, you know, that's kind of what you use them for, is the friend in a drama. The friend in the drama impacts the main character's life in some way. And when you have this, when you have the overly comedic friend, they had something bad ends up happening to him. When you have the over angry friend, they end up shooting somebody, killing somebody, or getting killed. Yeah. But this was nothing. This was a bunch of nothing between. They just took up space in the film for no good reason. And it just seemed like the best way I could call Tiptoes is aimless. They had the idea of making people understand what it's like to be a little person, but there was no aim in how to achieve that. It was just a lot of discombobulated scenes that had no cohesion and would have been even funny had, you know, somebody tripped over a little person, had they tried to reach for something,
had they been able to sneak into a small space that a full grown adult couldn't,
hung from a coat hanger. I mean, I'm just saying, the movie had a chance to even be funny, but it was so odd that it wasn't even. I laughed like when I first saw Gary Oldman in the motorcycle because how ludicrous it was, and the couch scene. But most of the times I was just like going, wow, this is just not a great film.
It's hard to predict how different people will view different movies.
Yeah.
And it's easy to say for all of these movies that we put into this, you know, competition, this bracket, I don't think you're going to like these movies.
Yeah.
But you can't predict exactly why. I think there are people, I mean, Kelsey thought Mac and Me was way better than Plan 9 from Outer Space. You and I felt differently about that because we could see the silver lining to one of those films more than the other. Mm-hmm. But I can guarantee anyone who watches this film, you haven't seen it before, will have the exact same visceral reaction that you and I had to it, which is confusion meets shock and horror.
Yeah.
And for a movie that tried so hard to inform all of us that there is a group of people out there who have it really rough, and have we ever thought about that, and have we ever considered it, and it's up to Hollywood to let us know about it, to go there and then fail so spectacularly.
Yeah.
I know. I recommend everybody watch this movie. It's a once-in-a-lifetime experience. Yeah. You can't rewatch it and get the same feeling that you'll get the first time.
Yeah.
All of these different things start to happen. It is chaos.
Yeah.
It's chaos. The guy was right.
Dirty. Yeah.
It's chaos.
And it's funny because you see Matthew McConaughey, who's gone on to have, you know, an amazing career, you know, Interstellar, Dallas Buyers Club, so many good movies that he's been able to be a part of. Lincoln Lawyer, I really enjoy. So he can look at this and laugh. Because this is at a time in his career that, yeah, he was kind of throwing everything out there. We're talking 23 years ago almost. Yeah. And he was just throwing things out there. And, you know, probably was, you know, talked into doing it because Gary Oldman was in it. And, you know, hey, he was going to do it. And it turned out to be a notch in his career that he can look back on and laugh. So it's nice that he can look back on and laugh and have such a good time. But
I mean, I will say, Greg, this pick.
Yeah.
This pick and Battlefield Earth pick really, really hit the crux of what we're trying to get to.
Yeah.
You were given everything.
Yeah.
And you gave us nothing.
No.
You know, some of these movies that we're watching, and Mano's Hands of Fate coming up, falls victim to this. You weren't given anything, so we don't get anything. That is a transaction that makes logical sense to me.
Yeah.
This is the poster child for what this bracket was supposed to be about, which is what the hell. So good job, Greg. You have my kudos for nailing the what the hell factor.
Well, that's the thing in regards to Tiptoes and Battlefield Earth. I think a movie is worse. And I mentioned it before we went on air and we were just talking. It's like, I think a movie is worse when you think you're making a good film. And you have this kind of arrogance about, hey, look at that. It's like the story that just came out recently. The Sony Pictures CEO said that Kraven the Hunter, which bombed mercilessly at the box office, Madam Web, and the latest Venom, these were all really good movies that were just savaged by the critics. And that's why nobody went to see them, because people were afraid. No, dude, these are really shitty movies. You made really good movies and you're telling us, you made really bad movies and you're telling us they're good. And it's to have that kind of delusion and that kind of arrogance to watch a movie like Madam Web. And I don't know if you've ever seen it.
I haven't.
It's on Netflix if you got it. I mean, you can see it just for the sheer train wreck that it is. It's a nightmare. Kraven the Hunter, I haven't seen yet because I'm not going to pay to go see it at the theaters, but I can look at the trailer and go, oh, that's a bunch of garbage. Morbius. These Sony tried to piggyback on the Marvel Universe by using their minor characters that they had the rights to that were all in the Spider-Man universe. And these movies are all shit. They're all absolute garbage. Morbius is laughably insane. But this Sony CEO is convinced that they're good. And that goes to these two movies, The Tiptoes and Battlefield Earth. I do believe these creators thought that they were making great films. Now, in the semblance of Plan 9 from Outer Space, Ed Wood was just having a good time. Mm-hmm. He knew what he was making wasn't a masterpiece, but he felt that people would have fun enjoying it. So even though it's a
woman, you're trying to make a superhero
romp
for the ages, right? You didn't do it well, but that's what you were trying to do. You weren't trying to make a great American masterpiece.
Yeah.
Mac and me, they were just trying to make a television commercial for Coke and McDonald's.
Exactly.
I'm with you.
When these things come about and you have the chance to make a film and you're an amateur, I have a little bit more tolerance for it, even though it's bad.
I expect results from an amateur.
Exactly. And so that brings us to the second movie, which is Manos, Hands of Fate, which is, as far as amateur gets, looks like it's made on 8mm film.
Yeah, someone's Super 8 camera that was uncovered, buried in an estate sale somewhere.
It
might as well be found footage.
Yeah, I mean, it has this look to it that is, there's a lot of bad movies that were made in this era of, made 1966, that were just these, you just get a Super 8, like they do with VHS nowadays, where they'll make a movie on VHS, and it'll just look, have that cheap look about it. But it can be ambitious, and this one was funny because it looked to me like they had no sound, no mic, and like
they didn't.
All the dialogue is overdubbed in a studio, which is obvious, painfully obvious, because sometimes it gets really, really loud. And you just look at the way the film is cut. I mean, it's interesting from that aesthetic. And it's like so many scenes of filler where they're just the scenes take an awfully long time to go anywhere.
Because they repeat themselves quite a bit. And I don't know if that's because of the editing, or they just, like you said, we're trying to fill up space or something. We get some more characters that don't make any sense in this movie. The two kids making out in the car who keep getting harassed by the cops. Not Torgo or whatever his name is. Tonto or
Torgo.
Pongo.
That's what I was looking for.
Yeah, these kids, they're just trying to get his dick wet.
And they keep showing him. The only thing they serve purpose is to point the family who get lost. They're going to Valley Lodge, or as in Mystery Science Theater, they say Valley Loogie. They're going to Valley Lodge for their getaway as a family, and they go down the wrong road. This couple who's openly have an open container, which the cop sees them with, and just basically tells them to leave, to drive after they've seen him with the open container. But they point the family down this road where it leads to the abandoned house. Or
they say at the beginning it's only 10 miles from town.
Yeah.
But they ended up
in the middle of nowhere.
But when they backtrack.
Maybe that's the mystery of how it happens. It's like a Stephen King thing where you just make one turn and you're in another dimension.
Well, that's what they say, because as they reach a dead end and they turn around, and then the wife says,
takes forever.
This wasn't here before when we came through this way. So it magically appeared. Pongo is standing at the door.
Well, first of all, before we get to Pongo, the guy on the right there, the husband, is Harold P. Warren. And he was the writer, the director, and star playing Michael, the husband, who has got a pretty young wife and a young daughter. And
she is a fox, dude. Yeah. She's smoking hot.
And the dog, the poodle dog.
Nipsey or Birdie or Prissy something.
Yeah, what was the dog's name?
Birdie, why am I going with 101 Dalmatians?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. So tell us more about this guy, because it lays the foundation for why this movie is what it is.
Well, it's the fact that he basically just had a chance to,
he made a bet with somebody
to make a movie. He had the opportunity. So why not just do this thing? He wrote the script. Which, to be honest with you, if you had a bigger budget, better equipment, better actors, better sets, better lighting, and better dialogue, the movie would still be shit. It would still be shit. It's a horrible. It's a horrible idea for a movie.
You have me going.
It is a horrible idea for
a
movie.
He made it for $10,000.
Yes, yeah.
It was never going to make sense.
No.
I mean, you could give me $10,000 today, it'd be gone tomorrow. I mean, that's how easily this stuff comes and goes. It was different in 1966 or whenever this came out.
He thought he made a great film. Like when Ed Wood said, this is my masterpiece. They had this extravagant premiere in El Paso, Texas.
But this didn't play nationwide. This wasn't distributed by some production company, distribution company. It played on three theaters in El Paso, Alpine, Texas, and Abilene, you know, or something. Kelsey, to her credit, after that goes, I don't think this deserves to be in the bracket. And I know why she said that. Because history is littered with amateurs making amateurish films that don't make any sense and are stupid. Now, maybe the writer and actor, Michael,
yes,
maybe he thought they made a good movie. But Torgo did not think they made a good movie. And you want to know how I know that, Greg?
Why is that?
Because he fucking killed himself a month before this movie.
Oh, well, holy shit. I knew that he was on LSD the whole time. Which they say that was why he explained for his twitching and his behavior in that, but he was
okay. Well, that makes a little more sense than just telling an amateur actor, "We want you to play a affected, you know, not quite off the deep end because the family does have to not trust is not the right word, but the family has to be at least comfortable enough to come in." Against their judgment.
I'm not going in.
I don't know.
I'm not going in. It's one of those things like that is...
Because it's getting dark out, Greg. And I busted out laughing. It is bright as the midday sun.
Let's look at that scene.
Okay.
Let's look at the scene because I've got that one. Just to introduce Torgo to the audience. This is Torgo when the family first arrives at the house. And they don't know what to do because they're lost. This is an insanity.
I am Torgo. I take care of the place while the master is away.
The stairs, the length of
scene. But the child, I'm not sure the master would approve. Or the dog. The master doesn't like children.
We only want to know where Valley Lodge is.
Which way do we go?
There is no place like that around here.
Spit it out.
Mike, I'm scared. It's getting dark.
Well, Torgo, which way is out of here?
There is no way out of here. It will be dark soon. There is no way out of here.
There is no way out of here. It's like, dude, spit it out, man. But there's so many scenes where I think because they knew they had to overdub, they had to dub the lyrics. So they would like roll them and you would get this just stare at the camera. One, two, three. Now speak.
Now.
Because it's so many scenes like that where they'll look at the camera almost directly into it and then say their line. It is amazing. So if you've never seen the film, of course, it was a Mystery Science Theater staple. This is why everybody knows about it. I think it probably played like midnight movie houses in the 60s because those 60s B films were kind of like those really bad ones were like in the 80s when video stores came out and video stores were just looking for something to stock on the shelves. So you had this just massive amount of B movies that were thrown out at the market and people picked them up and loved them because they were bad, but they were a way to spend an evening. In the 60s when you had these little theaters everywhere that were independently owned, they're always looking for something cheap they could throw up on the screen. So you had movies like this that came around, and that's the only time anybody would see them. But if you know the show Mystery Science Theater 3000, which I, you know, started watching in the 90s, and being a movie fan, I really loved it. I like the idea of heckling bad movies. This was like the movie, like the first few seasons. I think it's like season three. And it kind of like, if you watch this one, then you were hooked on the show, because they rip this thing apart. And the whole basis of it is just, it's a joy to watch. My wife will not watch this episode with me. She watched it with me once. I've watched it several times because it always makes me laugh. Their Mystery Science Theater version, that is. And she just can't even handle the movie so bad. She can't even handle the Mystery Science Theater cut because it's just not, it's just, it's that diabolically bad.
Yeah, the subject matter, it makes it hard, but I have seen that. I'm familiar with this movie because of Mystery Science Theater 3000 as well. And I don't believe that I, at the time, took the time to go watch the actual movie. But I mean, it was as bad as I expected it to be. I knew from the show that it's crazy and there's these long pauses and there's scenes. I mean, the car driving scene at the beginning.
Unbelievable.
Anything filmed from the inside, when they would cut to the outside, it's clearly not the same continuity. You know, it's like they just threw together any two scenes from inside and outside the car to make it look like they're traveling along this road 10 miles from where they live. That's a staycation, Holmes. But yeah, but again, the guy apparently was active in the local theater scene, which is probably a very low barrier to entry in El Paso, Texas in 1966, and made a bet in a coffee shop with a friend that he could make a movie. Made this for like $10,000, hired amateur local theater actors. I mean, I don't know how he got the smoking hot wife to be a part of it. She's so fine, dude. Her eyes are beautiful. Man, I really...
Well, at least you got something out of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, every time she's on screen, I was like, damn, girl.
Well, Torgo kind of takes a liking to her as well.
He does. Your hands off of my...
He does. He tries to the smoothest lines... In the world, the master has his own wife. I want a wife. I want somebody. He's just...
Yeah, you're making a really good case for yourself.
She is so hot that she gets creeped on by both Torgo and Manos themselves.
That's not Manos. That's the master. They pray to Manos.
They pray to Manos. You're right. You're right. It's like the Frankenstein. Hands. Yeah, the hands.
The hands. Yeah, hands of fate.
The master who would not approve. But the same window... Both of them creeping on the hot wife. And
they kill the dog. They can't leave.
Oh, the dog gets it right away, man. They're just gone. Right.
And then I'm sure it was a wild animal.
Then they have to wake the daughter up and tell her that
the dog's dead.
Yeah, when they say that it just ran away.
Yeah, while you were asleep, it left.
It just left.
It left. Which is such an open-ended, weird way to say that.
It left.
He left.
It's a weird thing because, I will say this. Midnight movies, a lot of creepy ones that back in the 60s and 70s that you could watch, with the lights out in the dark. And as this thing goes on, it does get an atmosphere or an aesthetic about it that is creepy because it's the way the Super 8's filmed. Kind of reminds me of like Sinister, where they have the Super 8 and the people get killed. It's still ludicrous. But the fact that you have this guy, the master, who is... supernatural or whatever, he has a million wives, does the sacrifices in a couple of the scenes, and so the family gets caught up in this, and he's gonna make the wife his next wife and whatever. The plot isn't much, but it's just at least enough. It's a very short film. I think it's 1 hour and 13 minutes, so you're mercifully ended.
You get more like 5 hours and 13 minutes.
To me, I was just amused. I mean, now granted, I'd seen the Mystery Science Theater, so watching it without Mystery Science Theater, I was just amused by how crappy everything was filmed. But the night scenes toward the end, where the cat fight is great.
Okay, that's the part where I started to think maybe this movie is going to take a turn. And I'm going to be into this. Maybe it gets this like Caligula type orgy. They're in these Romanesque robes and they're kind of see-through. You can see the granny panties that they're wearing underneath there.
Yeah. And I want the director's I want the director's cut.
Yeah, because
the fight is hilarious. I started to
feel a little horny. It ended quick because the fight, yeah, like you said, the fight's hilarious. It's real weird. Oh. And again, the music. Every time they cut, it's clear that they cut to some completely different take.
Yeah.
Maybe on a completely different day. I don't know.
Yeah.
I did read that they rented all this equipment, so they were just trying to get as much filmed at any given time as they could. And of course the quality is going to suffer, or you're going to be more likely to be okay with small mistakes or whatever when time is of the essence. They film night for night shots here, which, you know, for people who don't know, modern movies, nighttime scenes are still filmed in the daytime and they just have the ability to make it look like it's night. This is night for night, but what it did, and you can see it in the fight scene specifically, is the lights attracted moths. And so Super 8 film, weird action sequences with a bunch of moths flying around because the lights have brought attracted moths in. It was so good, but I mean, I did pause it at one point to see how much longer we had in the movie. We had like 25 minutes left. Yeah. I was like, okay, that's fine. Yeah. But like, who gives a shit? You're watching a shitty film made by an amateur filmmaker.
Yeah.
Again, it does meet the requirement of so bad it's good, not because it's a good film. And I really can't even say that it's one of those where, okay, the film's bad, but you'll have a good time watching it. Because I don't know that I had a good time watching it. But it is fuel for conversations like the one we're having, which is the same conversations that friends have over drinks in bars all across the world, where you start to talk about the worst whatever.
Yeah.
What's the worst car you ever owned? You know, my first car was a 1984 Chevy Cavalier. You know, it was a real piece of shit. And we bond over talking about bad things we've experienced. Not tragic trauma bad, but just funny bad. Your most embarrassing moment. You know, your... What's a weird rule your family had growing up that you didn't realize was weird until you got older? These are fun things to talk about. And the fact that Hands of Fate can be fuel for that type of conversation is great. It's what makes this worthwhile to exist in the world, because otherwise it doesn't have any reason to exist at all. No. It was one man's vanity project where he made a bet. And I remember in Plan 9 last episode, I said, if you gave us $250,000, you couldn't make a better movie than Plan 9 from Outer Space. But this is what happens when you get 1/25th of that budget and are asked to make a movie. I mean, no one asks this guy to make a movie, but it's what happens when you only have that much money and you try to make a movie. It's going to be shit. Sorry.
You know, like you said, just to echo what you said, it is, you're right. It's not, it's a so bad, it's good movie. It's a so bad, it's bad to where you have to talk about it like a train wreck. And it's so funny because I know my wife can't stand it after she literally couldn't even stand the Mystery Science Theater version. It's so, it insults her intelligence as a audience member. So there are I love the Mystery Science Theater version. It's so many good jokes, makes me laugh. And there are times where I can just put it on when she's like on her phone and I'll just put it on. She will immediately get up and leave the room. This is an ongoing joke that we have. And the movie itself is, like I said, the ending's irrelevant, even though it's kind of funny because Michael ends up becoming the new caretaker. Torgo ends up dying. The wife and the daughter become the master's new slaves. And then we get the whole typical cliched, the end with a question mark with the dog. I love the painting. And you kind of walk away with just kind of a chuckle at the end of all of it. It's a very short watch. It's not inoffensive to you. It's not, again, not like Plan 9. Plan 9 to me is it's a so bad it's good. It's a so bad it's great. Like,
I could, it's quirky.
Yes.
It's, yeah. It's lighthearted. Oh, it's, yes.
Watching Plan 9 again, I didn't think I could laugh at such a bad movie. And it's unintentionally funny, but it's intentionally funny too. Yeah. To me, the king of bad movies as far as enjoyable ones. This one I've watched over and over from a cult following, of course, with Mystery Science Theater, but I still have watched it a lot because of it's so bad. So I'm very familiar with this film. In fact, I got just a couple of photos for you because I went to see Mystery Science Theater live. And actually, oh, nice. Back in the day, this is like 2016, 2015.
Dude, yeah, look how young you look.
I know, dude, how young
what the fuck happened to you?
I know, right? Well, that was a lot more way to go, too. But if you look at the shirt that I'm wearing, it's a Manos shirt.
Master would not approve.
would not approve. A couple of guys had their own Tom Servo and Crow at the theater, and then of course a guy was dressed as Manos himself over there on the right.
Not Manos, that's the master.
The master, I know it is. Can't help
you're going to offend me by not paying attention to the plot and characters in this movie.
I can't help it. It's just one of the things I've always done is always referred to him as Manos. But yeah, I do have a Master Does Not Approve t-shirt. I couldn't find it. I was going to wear it tonight. Couldn't find it.
Bummer.
It's been a while since I've worn it, but I used to wear it out. And what was so funny is I would wear that out and people would recognize and they'd point at it and laugh and go, oh my gosh, where did you get that?
It's so, like being part of an inside joke, yeah. A club of people who watch, I mean, what is quite literally the worst movie ever made, but this is where we have to start hedging how we determine winners and losers in this bracket, because objectively speaking, Manos Hands of Fate is probably the worst movie ever made. But is it any worse than any other B-budget $10,000 movie made in the 60s by an amateur who had never made a movie before using amateur actors? No, it is not any worse than any of those movies. I'm certain of that. It's like if you order a diarrhea sandwich, then you can't be surprised that it tastes like shit.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I just kind of watched it as I sat there in shock and horrored bemusement watching Tiptoes. I just watched this one as like, I just want to remember how bad this is from having seen Mystery Science Theater so long ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
Remind me what made this such fodder for being made fun of? And I mean, they do such a good job because there's really not a lot of material to work with. Like in the scene you showed us, there's so much awkward space, not awkward pauses, awkward space.
Yeah.
That doesn't belong. And there's not a lot of action to speak of. It all happens in basically one space. And, you know, it's just weird in that way. It's just kind of a combination of everything unimaginative and uncreative and unprofessional. But again, it is exactly what you would expect if I described a movie using those adjectives and then showed you this, you'd go, well, yeah, I mean, that was unimaginative, amateurish, and I don't even know if it's weird. It's just weird because it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it's just not a great film because, again, like I said, the low budget, the way it's filmed, the way it's dubbed, it's just a disaster. But that being said, is, which I think what we determined when we started looking at this bracket was like, when we have a good movie, and we're doing box office battles with good films, which would you rather watch again is kind of the defining characteristic. And I honestly, for me, I don't ever want to watch Tiptoes again. I've watched it twice now in my lifetime. I'm done with that film. But I know for a fact I will watch Manos, the Hands of Fate again. I might, you know, if I live to be 80, God willing, I will watch this movie 15, 20 more times just because, in Mystery Science Theater version, I don't think I'll watch the regular version again. I may. I don't, it doesn't matter. But
so that's one way to look at it. And I think the other is this, because it's a totality of the circumstances that each of the films was produced in.
Yeah.
And so I look at it like this. If I am given a Ferrari and they give you a Pinto,
yeah,
and we race and I beat you, Greg, by half a second. I mean, technically speaking, I won that race.
Yes.
But all things considered, given the tools we were given here,
yeah,
I'm a real loser for not being able to beat you in a Pinto while I'm in a Ferrari.
Exactly.
And so I think there's a relativism at play here. And I'm with you. I just, Tiptoes was too off-putting.
Yeah.
And not only off-putting and not only bizarre, but you had two future Academy Award winners. You have Peter Dinklage, who's built a
Golden Globes plus for
year
Game career. Of Thrones. Yep.
Yeah. Was in Elf. Was it, you know,
he's an angry things. Elf. I did he's mention to my wife, though, we were watching, she watched a part of Tiptoes with me, and we were kind of thinking about it. We're like, man, is that the only thing he does, Peter Dinklage, is just be angry all the time? Because he is angry in Game of Thrones. He's angry in Elf. I'm like, has he never not been angry? Is that like his thing? He's an angry elf. And I just happen to wonder about that. I've never seen him do.
I mean, he's good at doing
what that he does.
Thing.
I guess when you're small and you're disrespected. And it's the whole thing with like I kind of got annoyed with him when he felt that the seven dwarves in the new Snow White shouldn't be dwarves.
They should not be dwarves?
Yeah. He advocated for just using normal size because that's stereotypical.
Seven grown-ass men?
Yeah. And it was like, dude, there are a lot of little people actors that's their role. That's what they're waiting for. And so Peter Dinklage is odd to me. I really loved him in Game of Thrones, but outside of that, eh. And then watching this, I kind of went, eh, whatever. But back to your point, so many good people in it. Had a better budget, supposed to be a mainstream movie. And I think it's more insulting when it doesn't give us what we want and compared to Manos. And so when we were doing this and we were talking about, hey, we should do this more often, these bad movies, I think yes, but for this one, we should talk about the real shit movies and crown the shittiest movie ever because we expected more from it. If we do these in the future, we can start talking about the bad movies that we enjoyed. Not so bad, it's good, just the fact that we enjoyed it. Because there is a lot of those, like Manos and like Plan 9 especially, but there's a lot of those out there, like the Ray Harryhausen, Claymation, Sinbad movies and the Hercules shit that are really, really bad, but very, very enjoyable that we could have more fun with. For this bracket, though, I think it's just the ones that are absolute shit that insult our intelligence, and we need to crown the shittiest movie ever made based on that criteria. So my vote for this week, as far as the one I do not want to ever see again, as much as I like all of the actors in it and love Gary Oldman, I never want to watch Tiptoes again. So that's my vote for the loser for this week.
My vote is for Tiptoes as well. It was, as you said, an insult to all of the progress that midgets have made over
keep saying midgets
that dwarves have made over all of the years. And right at a time where they were about to turn the corner, this movie had the ability to set their progress back 200 years. You know how many kids were able to be put through college because little people were in The Wizard of Oz?
Yeah. I don't know.
And I think Peter Dinklage...
I don't know. You asked if I knew.
By the way...
I don't know.
Peter Dinklage talking some shit about the Seven Dwarves movie. First of all, that's how that story was written. You can like it or not, and you can debate whether or not we should be making reimagined versions of problematic stories. If you think that's problematic, fucking fine, but we're not using seven adult dudes like it's Ocean's 11 cast or something. Second of all, it fucking reeks of climbing the ladder and cutting the rungs behind you on the way up, you fucking piece of shit. You don't think that there's other people out there that could use a little work every now and then just because you are living off of your Game of Thrones money?
You don't see Warwick Davis doing that shit. Warwick Davis played an Ewok, for crying out loud. Warwick Davis played Leprechaun, for crying out loud. He played freaking Goblin in Harry Potter. He is the king, to me, of the dwarf actors. I like Warwick Davis a lot. Grew up with him in Willow and all that shit. So, I agree. You got this. Mike Levitovitz says that you guys rock as always. Love the show so much. Probably because of your rant.
He likes a good rant. Like,
you gotta have a good rant. But yes, our bad movies winner for this week is definitely Tiptoes compared to Manos, which Manos was the number two seed, so this is kind of an upset. And honestly, not really how I thought it would go when going into this, and I never do. I never know how these are going to go till I watch them. But I think as I watch this, I watched Manos last week, and I actually didn't have a bad time. I kind of laughed at, oh, God, this is really bad. Then I put on Tiptoes yesterday, and I was just, like, staring at the screen going, oh, my God. I couldn't even get, like, I laughed a couple times just how ludicrous, like I said earlier. But then overall, it was just a bad film. And the fact that it's so disjointed, it's there's so many other bad films that I would watch over this 100 times over. So I think we made the right choice. So we've got...
Congratulations, Tiptoes.
Before we go, do want to mention, if you like the show, if you love the show, please go to one of our sites, either at Twitch, which is Box Office Battle Pod, and subscribe. Go to both. You can go to YouTube at Box Office Battle Podcast. Just look for us, Box Office Battle with Greg and Eric. You can find us on YouTube. Give us a subscribe. And if you've already subscribed, tell other people. So we can keep doing this. We do this for free. We do this because we like movies, and we do this because Eric and I like to bullshit with each other about movies. And that's why we started this whole thing, and we're on our 14th episode. We want to keep it going. So please do that. If you have an idea for a topic for us to do on Box Office Battles, a category that you want to see us take apart, make sure you email us. You can go to our Facebook page, which is Box Office Battles with Greg and Eric. Or you can email us at boxofficebattles, all one word, @gmail.com. Now, I was thinking of a future. We still got to get to the final four. But I was thinking of a future category the other day. And I saw clips from a few movies that I was like, I don't even know how it came about. But I think it was just watching a British show. And the movie Tommy came up. Have you ever seen Tommy by The Who?
I don't think so. Who's Tommy?
Yes.
I mean, I'm familiar with it. I haven't seen it.
It is extremely bizarre. And it got me to thinking, there are movies that are considered good, use air quotes for those who can't see on the podcast, and then some that are just bizarre good, you know, that they're good, but they're weird. And there's a lot of weird films out there. There's movies like Eraserhead, Tommy, Phantom of the Paradise is another one that I've seen recently that from the 70s, that's like Phantom of the Opera, but done as a 70s rock opera. It's exactly what you think it is. Okay. It's insane.
So I hate it so far.
So maybe a future category would be the top 8 weirdest films ever made. Doesn't have to be bad films. If you've never seen Eraserhead or a David Lynch film like Mulholland Drive, which are very out there. They're good, they're thought-provoking, but they're not for everybody. They're clearly not for everybody. Tetsuo, a Japanese film, Tetsuo the Iron Man, extremely bizarre. So that might be something we do in a future category. But if you have a category that you want us to do, just email us at boxofficebattles@gmail.com. Our next broadcast is going to be the 21st of January. That's going to be the live stream with the podcast soon to follow after on all of our platforms, Amazon Music. And we also do Spotify. We do Apple and so many others. So make sure you follow us on those as well. But our next live stream is going to be Tuesday, 21st of January. It is our final first round battle. And it's going to be The Room, the goat, I guess you would say, of all bad movies that has ever been made. I mean, it just recently became infamous as being the goat versus a movie that had a huge, huge budget, goes back to all these other ones that we're talking about, Battlefield Earth, and probably the biggest budget of any of the movies in the top eight, and so underperformed in Kevin Costner's Waterworld. It's going to be an interesting battle between those two as we rewatch these and discuss it.
Yeah, The Room was the reason that I suggested this topic or category in the first place, and Waterworld was immediately the second movie that popped into my mind when I thought about so bad they're good, or just really bad movies that underperformed, or however we're defining it. So I've never seen either one of these movies.
Oh,
so
really?
I'll be excited. No, I'm going in virgin.
I'm going to admit something that I don't want to say I'm ashamed of. I'm not. I have Waterworld on 4K.
Okay, man. You're going to tell me about how it really... Oh, man, I forgot to mention.
Okay.
Back to Mano's Hands of Fate for a second. It's not just that it was so amateurish. Man, the music in this thing is the zaniest combination of like bebop, jazz, like kind of some of it. Kind of good.
It's not bad.
Like xylophone jazz, which not be bad. Real
Bobby Hutcherson. Pace. Bobby Hutcherson's a great xylophone. It's vibraphone is what they call it.
Vibraphone.
Yeah. I have to admit, I was getting sucked into the music a little bit on Mano's Hands of Fate. I ain't gonna
lie. There's one where a lady starts singing. Oh, I was like, all right, well, that's a little much. But I mean, it was such an odd juxtaposition. I know we're trying to wrap up, but I just remembered, like, as bad as that was, there were times where I was like, man, I could jam to this. Like, I could listen to a playlist of like 60s bebop, Latin fusion jazz for a while, anyway, until I got a headache.
Yeah, I really, that's a good point. I wanted to make that earlier. I forgot about that. The soundtrack, again, it's not Alan Silvestri from Mac and Me, but it's a very interesting soundtrack. Better soundtrack. So let's contrast real quick before we go. So the soundtrack for Mano's Hands of Fate is this really scatty bebop jazz. It's actually kind of distracting from how bad the movie is at times.
Yeah,
it is. And then you've got Tiptoes, which can't decide what the hell it wants to be. Like, we saw the thing with McConaughey. It has this, like, upbeat, like a rom-com, like we talked about. It has no identity. It has rom-com soundtrack, then serious, then upbeat, then serious. There's the tones throughout Tiptoes is so disjointed. And that's in the soundtrack as well.
They think they can control... What they fail to do with the acting, dialogue, character development, whatever, they think they can get you to do through the use of music. And guess what? You can do that when you do it correctly and well. I mean, they didn't. It can be done, but
it's a bipolar soundtrack. Because the movie finishes with that dramatic scene where Gary Oldman and Kate Beckinsale start to kiss, and then it goes,
wow, I feel good.
It makes no sense. So once again, join us on our next live stream in 2 weeks, 21st of January, The Room versus Waterworld. Also, we're going to have this podcast out on Spotify and Amazon Music within the next couple of days. Tell your friends, refer them to it, have them subscribe so you always get the latest podcast. So our numbers go up for that. One thing I will say about the 21st of January, we will have a special guest. For those of you who don't know, when I was living in England, I did radio in the UK for about 3 years. And I had we did a Friday night countdown show there on local British radio in near Lake Neath in Cambridge. I was on Cambridge Sun for a long time. And my radio partner, Dr. K, my pseudonym was Greg Allen, and he was Dr. K. We did the Friday night.
Dr. K, the medicine woman.
That's Dr. Quinn, but very close.
Uh-oh.
But no, he kind of sent me a message. He's been listening to the show and popping in and out. And he was like, hey, if you ever want me to just come in and just give my take on something. And I said, hey, that's fine with me. I'll run it by Eric. He's a very funny guy. And he loves The Room. So he was like, dude, if you're doing The Room, I'm in. So I said, okay. We will have a guest on the 21st. It'll be Dr. K. His real name's Matt, but we're going to call him Dr. K. That's what he knew. We'll talk about our radio days, I'm sure. We had a great 3-year run. It was a lot of fun on British radio. So I'm glad to welcome him aboard. We stayed friends. We got regular jobs. And so now we're going to do this. So anyway, that all being said, thanks again so much to everybody for joining tonight. And for all of those who are watching this on YouTube, we're averaging, several views on YouTube. So we want to keep that going and get those up. The numbers that we have on our podcast, just the audio streams, continue to increase. And we want to thank all of you for doing that. And we appreciate you getting the word out and just continue to do so. So we can continue to do this for you guys. So again, next one is 21 January, Box Office Battles, Greg and Eric, The Room versus Waterworld. And I will turn it over to Eric to say his final words.
Until the 21st of January, you guys be excellent to each other. We'll check up with you then.
Have a great, great rest of the week, guys. And if you're in the South or anywhere where we're getting a lot of snow, stay warm and we love you. Take care, guys.